Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're into, we're in the fish course.
We are.
We're right in the heart of this dinner party that we're doing.
Sole is such a great fish.
I mean, you've been doing champagne. It's an easy transition depending upon how rich. If it's sole, you talk about sole and salmon. Sole, easy to do a great Chablis and do a Premier Cru, do a Grand Cru. Premier Cru Chablis from a good producer is not a giant piece of money. It's not like buying a bottle of Le Marronche or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or alternately, from the right kind of vintage, 2008, 2010, even maybe 11, Pliny Marronche, something nice and nervy. If you cannot get that done, then even just Village Chablis from a good producer like Servin, S-E-R-V-I-N, or Monnier, M-O-S-N-I-E-R. Those guys make beautiful stuff, but sole, easily going that way. Salmon, I actually would rather have Chenin Blanc from the Loire. So if you're doing, say you're doing a sauce that's rich with that too, it's going to have enough acid to cut that. So whether if it's Vouvray, make it something drier and then sweeter in Vouvray. There's some wine possibilities with that. Do you have any idea what other fish I'm going to propose?
No. Go ahead. Do it. Let's hear it.
I love monkfish.
Oh,
I love monkfish, and
you
I
know
think
I don't.
Which I will never understand because it's beautiful. Because
the
meat is almost the same way that lobster meat is. You get like big fat sweet knuckles of
and it acts like lobster.
It.
You have to be very careful when you cook it.
Which means it's easy to overcook.
Exactly.
If you get beautiful monkfish and you cook it gently, it's easy to cut into large enough pieces that you can roast them in the pan and finish them in the oven,
mm-hmm.
and have them finished very nicely. You can sear them off in the pan ahead, have them in the fridge, bring them out a little bit ahead,
and cook it through.
Go right back into a sheet pan with just butter,
mm-hmm.
and a little bit of white wine.
Well, monkfish definitely likes butter.
Yeah, and it's almost like warmed up by being half poached in the butter and the wine. You could add herbs to that, a little tarragon, something like that.
That sounds very good.
And the sauce, the old-fashioned sauce that I love with that is sauce Chiron, which is hollandaise, but adding tomato to it for a little bit of acidity. And that changes the wine pretty substantially. That
sure.
takes the wine down south for me. That whether it's, if you want to stay in France, it's going down the Rhone Valley, and it's white chestnut to pop, that's great with that. If you want to go into Spain, there are wines from the northwest of Spain, from the grape Godejo, that are fabulous.
Mm.
That would be awesome to have with that, but I have a great affinity for monkfish.
Well, the thing about monkfish too, it's a sweeter fish. It's a very ignore what I said. Of course, I don't hate monkfish, but it's a fish that I think, you know, it's a tremendous amount of work. You have to peel the outside of it. You have to really clean it up,
it's an incredibly ugly fish.
Yeah, but it can be really beautiful, and it is referred to as a poor man's lobster. So,
and it's easy
to really
do nice vegetable garnishes with that.
Absolutely,
you can confit fennel. You can braise celery root.
It has a lot of potential.
Yeah,
monkfish.
No question.
Very good.
All right, so we're gonna head into our producer segment. We have Arno Weirich. Am I saying it correctly?
Yes, it's a tough one. So, yes, Weirich, you know, it seems like the most American way to pronounce it.
Well, Arno is the winemaker at Rotor Estate in Mendocino, California, a super beautiful place to visit, and in my opinion, the best quality sparkling wine producer in the U.S. How long have you been there, Arno?
Yeah, I've been in California for 13 years now, but I first came as a young just out of college students back in 1993. So I've seen a little bit of what happened in California and in the Anderson Valley since 93.
And did you originally train in Champagne, or?
Yeah,
tell me about what your path has been to get there.
I was born and raised in France. I'm from Alsace. So I'm from a white wine country, and then ended up going to college in the south of France. Like any young guy, you want to go and see, you know, where it's warmer and nicer. So I ended up at the school of Montpellier in the south of France on the Mediterranean coast. And that's where I studied winemaking and vineyard management. And I got a master's degree from the school of Montpellier back in 1993. And that's where I traveled to California for an internship that was supposed to last 6 months over harvest, and apparently I was doing a good job, and I had the chance to be asked to stay longer. I ended up staying 2 years, 93 to 95. That was kind of an extended stay to work on vineyard projects, mainly at Rodeway State here in the Yenison Valley. And then went back to France for about 5 years. I had a girlfriend waiting for me over there. That's usually what happens. You know? And we went back to it together, worked both of us in the very close suburbs of Paris. I was not in making wine directly, but I was dealing with a lot of suppliers, French and European suppliers, dealing with beverages under private label for a large retail chain. So I was on the other side of the fence, in a way.
How did you like that side of the fence?
Well, it was a very intense job because I was, you know, everything was to be done yesterday. So it was a constant rush on everything. But I happened to meet a lot of suppliers from many different backgrounds. I was dealing with a bottled mineral water to beer and fruit juices, but also sparkling wine, champagne. I had to travel a lot in France, so I even was going to Portugal and going to the Highlands in Scotland to check up on my whiskey suppliers. So I gained a lot of knowledge on many, many different things. After a couple of years, it's interesting. After a couple of years, you feel like, you know, it's a little too much to be constantly, you know, traveling. So that's when I kept a very good relation with the family who owns Champagne Urdaire and Rodeway Estate, and we'd be talking to each other once a year, usually around the time of the New Year's. And then what happened is, I got one of those New Year's greeting cards from Jean-Claude Rousseau, the chairman of the board back then, and he asked me what I was doing. And And I told him, well, this is what I'm doing, and I don't like it anymore. And I was looking at ways to possibly change job, and that's how I got the offer to, if I wanted to throw my hat in the ring, to possibly apply for the job here as a winemaker for Rodeway Estate back in California.
Because the winemaker prior to you was Michel, right?
Was Michel Salg, yes. And he first...
And he was the original winemaker on that estate?
That's correct. And he stayed for 18 years, arrived in 1986. And so we worked together for a couple of years. So I came back on the team in 2000, and Michel left in 2003, and I officially took over in July of 2003. So in the wine business, there's always this type of overlap. It's like,
Of course.
I'm sure Cindy would concur with that, that you need the some overlapping when the chef trains the new
Absolutely.
Chef, or sous chef. There's a lot of things you can learn in books, but there's a lot of things you can only learn by doing, listening, tasting, and things like that.
So, well, and every year is so different. To have experienced hands with you in dealing with those conditions for a couple of years is pretty important, I would think.
Right, and you're always learning. I mean, it's the learning curve is endless. Of course, we have the chance to be dealing with only one ingredient. It's grapes, so it's not like cooking where you have to deal with many, many ingredients. But it looks like Mother Nature is always is always different. Every year, it throws you a different curveball, and you have to learn. And then you think you know everything, and then you learn more the next year, and so forth. So, and it's only once a year, so I guess you don't want to mess it up.
So tell people about producing sparkling wine versus producing still wine. Is it harder or is it easier?
Well, I would tend to say it is more difficult. So, of course, I'll try to explain why.
I think it's definitely more difficult.
Right. There are more steps. And so you start, to make sparkling wine, you start making... still wine, but you pick your grapes earlier than for regular red or white still wine. In the case of sparkling wine, there would be méthode champenoise, so that would be made as in the style of Champagne, but not in Champagne.
So you pick them earlier and less ripe because of why?
So you want to pick earlier in order to keep the acidity level fairly high. Also because you don't want to get too many of the phenolics. And phenolics is the large family that covers the tannins and also the pigments, the color, the anthocyanin. So in a way, to do a quick comparison, everything that is a quality item in a still wine would be some kind of a defect in sparkling. That's maybe a little far-fetched, but sparkling wine is all about elegance, acidity, and not about color or tannins or phenolics, and versus red wine would be more about color, density of the wine, complexity of aromatics and color.
You're chasing different goals. You're chasing intensity, precision of expression, length. You're not chasing density, corpulence, the broad expression.
That's correct. And also, if you look at exactly which part of the berry, the grape berry, is what you are working with, for a white wine or sparkling wine, you're basically dealing with the pulp, which is the juice quality, versus if you're making a red wine, you're dealing a lot with the skin quality. So the pigments, the color are in the skin.
So many people are surprised to find out that sparkling wine is made usually, especially in Champagne, but I think also for you, with as many or more red grapes than white grapes.
That is correct. So it sounds crazy, but yes, we make, in the case of Rodeway Estate, 60% of what's in the bottle comes from Chardonnay, but 40% comes from Pinot Noir, that is a red variety. So the basic step of the sparkling wine making is to handpick all your grapes, the red and white, and to press them right away, so there's no to avoid any skin contact. You don't want to have any contact of the liquid and the solids together, because then you would extract the tannins and the color, the pigments, from the skin, and then you would have something that is not desired in a sparkling. So if you press right away, you separate your liquid fraction from the solid fraction, and you end up having a very, very lightly colored Pinot Noir juice. So depending on the clones and maturity level, you can have a slightly more color, but not too much, which tends to disappear during the process of fermentation and the next step in the process. So the building blocks are definitely that juice of Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, low alcohol, usually 11% alcohol, and higher acid. For those that are chemistry geeks, usually a pH is around 3 to 3.1 pH, so it's a fairly acidic wine. So you never see or taste those base wines, because they are always worked with, and the chance to taste them is extremely limited. So they only last for a couple of months, because the next step is to blend those base wines of Pinot and Chardonnay according to, not a recipe, but according to a style that you are trying to maintain. Is it more on a Chardonnay style, more fruity, more on the acid, some kind of a youthful character, or more on the Pinot side, who tends to have slightly more body, more character, due to the brought by the Pinot that has a little bit of tannins, even though it's pressed right away. It does bring a little bit of tannins.
So how different is chasing that character of Chardonnay and Pinot in Mendocino versus chasing it in Champagne?
A lot of it comes from the climate characteristics of the place. So Champagne is known to be fairly up north in France. It's a continental climate, cold winters, warmer summers, but at a latitude that's the latitude of Washington State. Versus Mendocino is definitely California weather. We are the latitude of the south of Spain, so quite a huge difference. But we're on the coast side. So dealing with this, it still means the coastal Anderson Valley being very much under that Pacific weather pattern that brings cooler weather, fog, does allow the overall temperature to cool down.
So you have a more easily moderated climate, but you're,
right.
but you're that much closer to the sun, so it's got to change the character of the skins of the grapes.
Exactly.
But, but the skins are not what you're chasing, so that really is not the end of the world, is it?
Right. So we even though we are close enough to the weather, to the temperature average of Champagne, we're still a little warmer. It means the grapes tend to ripen a little faster than in Champagne.
I've got one last quick question for you, Arnaud. So what is your favorite American, ridiculous American food to have with Roeder Estate sparkling wine?
I guess I have more than one. Being on in the Anderson Valley, which is not 18 miles away from the Pacific coast, we tend to have great crab season. The Dungeness crab over here, but also some of the wild salmon that we can, that can be fished offshore. So I tend to like my Roeder Estate with the crab. That works very well, especially the rosé, the non-vintage rosé.
Shows a little bit sweeter fruit.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much for coming on the program. It's one of my all-time favorite visits is up to the Mendocino and to the Anderson Valley, and you guys are fantastic hosts when people visit, and the wines are beautiful that you guys are making.
Thank you, Tony, and it was a pleasure talking to you, and I hope everything goes fine for you in beautiful Maryland.
Well, we will do our best, and we'll make sure we put a link to Roeder Estate up on the Foreman & Wolf webpage on the WYPR site. Thanks so much, Arnaud.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you. Have a good day. Thanks so much for listening to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. And today we talked we basically came up with a beautiful dinner party, a very, very special one with lots of sort of old classic dishes, and Tony pairs the wines. And really, in the end, it's that beautiful marriage of food and wine that makes a very special dinner party, as well as the people that you invite and getting everyone to dress up and bringing out some of your beautiful pieces of silver or crystal or things that are special to your family and having a wonderful night together. So it's all about a larger dinner party that's very special.
Thanks for listening to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. You can email us at foremanwolf@wypr.org with any questions about food, wine, travel. And we look forward to presenting next week's program with the second half of the dinner party.